So I said, okay, well, our mission now is to go interdict these rat lines, and we can measure our effectiveness by the amount of kinetic activity going on in Helmand and Kandahar. So that was really my introduction to technology. And I said, man, I think the door is barely even open to this revolution, and I really want to be a part of it, but not necessarily just on the user side. I want to help kind of build businesses around that. We all realize that we're pumping out just all kinds of signals every single day with everything that we're connected to, right? It's pretty ridiculous. But what if we weren't looking at it at purchasing power, buying intent? What if we looked at it from a security standpoint? What if we said, hey, look, this pattern here is an indicator of something to happen, right? It's an indicator of a potential breach or violent activity.
Welcome to Secure Access with John Dillard, your front door to the future of compliance, security, and tech. Powered by Sinon Solutions, we bring you bold conversations with industry leaders who are shaping how organizations protect people, data, and spaces. If you're serious about smarter, safer access, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Hey, welcome, Jim, to the podcast. Thank you for taking the time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We've met a couple times, I think, in the last few years because of your work at Torchlight and my work at Sinon. So I'm excited to kind of dig into the details. What I love to do to start out is just ask you how in the world you got started. How did Jim end up sitting across the table talking about security? Tell us about your background.
Yeah, fair enough. I spent my formative years in the Army. I was planning on enlisting coming out of high school. My father, who was enlisted in Vietnam, had some words of wisdom for me. Said, go to college. That was about the only advice I took from him. So I went to college first, but I ended up going to VMI because I was 18 and wanted to see how tough I was. The plan was to get a commission in the Army, which I did. That was in the spring of 2001. Had a three-year commitment to Uncle Sam. And then about 6 months later, September 11th happened. And
right.
It was pretty fast and furious. For the next 10 years, I started out my life in the military in the 82nd Airborne and the infantry, jumping out of planes. We basically deployed to Afghanistan very quickly right after I got there. Before the invasion of Iraq, I actually watched the invasion of Iraq from Afghanistan. And then we got home and we turned around real quick and they sent us to Iraq. So I spent some time there as well. During my first mission in Afghanistan, we were going to clear a compound and I'm getting ready to move in and meet the village elders. And these big white guys with long beards show up on my objective driving pickup trucks. I said, hey, wait a second, what's going on? And, you know, they were American Special Forces. And I said, that's what I thought I was going to be doing. That's what I really want to do. So
you didn't know you could grow a beard. You didn't
exactly right. It was the driver. That was the driver. So, you know, as soon as I could, I went to selection and wanted to do that. I liked how they, you know, and I spent a lot more time out in Afghanistan with some Special Forces teams. So I really got to see how they operated, and I was really drawn to it, right? I liked the small team. I liked the asymmetric thinking and getting stuff done in a very creative way. I really kind of was drawn to that. So not as much room for creativity in the infantry. So I decided to make the jump over. I had a great time and, you know, went to Afghanistan a couple more times. So my three-year commitment turned into 10 pretty quickly. And at the end of 10, I kind of looked around and said, you know, do I want to do this for the rest of my 10 or not? And around that time was when Palantir was starting to kind of tape off, get down to some of the lower level units. And I never laid hands on it, but some of the higher headquarters did. And we had some more rudimentary technology. But that's what really started getting me in the mind of how can technology change how we do intelligence, how we do operations, how we plan our missions, and truly understand the intent of the adversary, which is really the point of intelligence. And I was able to use some of this technology to great effect and have some really tangible results. You know, the big, where I was in 2007 and 8 in Afghanistan, we were over in the western part close to Pakistan. It was relatively quiet there. That was when Helmand and Kandahar had all of the kinetic activity going on. And we got snowed in and I had my team sit down and compile into digits these written intel reports over the past 6-7 years. And we were then able to plot it on a map, and very quickly we were start to really understand the environment in a way we couldn't before. And what we realized is we were sitting smack dab in what we call the Taliban Underground Railroad. Folks, men and fighters and materiel coming from Pakistan through our backyard over to Helmand and Kandahar to, you know, set up IEDs, blow up U.S. soldiers, have ambushes, that type of things. And so it became, you know, the technology very quickly helped me understand in a way what my mission was. So I said, okay, well, our mission now is to go interdict these rat lines, and we can measure our effectiveness by the amount of kinetic activity going on in Helmand and Kandahar. So that was really my introduction to technology. And I said, man, I think the door is barely even open to this revolution, and I really want to be a part of it, but not necessarily just on the user side. I want to help kind of build businesses around that. So that was my intent, and I left the military to go and do that.
Did it occur to you, I might be able to get a job after I get out of here? I mean, what did you put two and two together, or at what point did you realize, okay, this is the thing that I will do after I separate?
Yeah, I think it was a gradual, right? I had an idea. I said, oh man, that's really interesting. So I really started exploring graduate programs. Didn't really know anything about business. So where can I go get trained on business and understand what it means, but then really use my background in the military to move into this, you know, security, defense, technology space, which is, I think the timing is really, really good. It has really kind of blown up as I've grown with it. So the first step was really going to understand business and kind of see where the industry was and where it was going. What I really didn't want to do was go be a private contractor. You know, a lot of folks went and did that. But I really wanted to go and kind of create things, going back to the creative nature of what I'd been doing before. So I really wanted to leverage what I'd done, kind of that operational experience, and then take it in the business.
It's really interesting. I mean, the folks that I've interviewed on this podcast, I mean, we've had guy who built Meta's program, the guy who built SpaceX's program. There are a number who started out sort of in the executive protection kind of zone. You came out with not a dissimilar background from yours, but they took a decidedly non-technical, you know, path. And then they have subsequently, by the way, been pulled in your direction because there's no way to do what we need to do without advanced tools and the kind of things that you're building.
Yeah.
If you think about your peer group, your leadership peer group, in the military, you could be in the officer corps, but in the enlisted guys too. Do you get the sense that you were on an island thinking about this stuff then? Or were there other folks who were beginning to realize that these tools like Palantir, the things we're getting exposed to and the way we're solving these problems, that's the direction rather than sort of kicking doors?
I feel like I was on a bit of an island, right? Because everybody likes kicking doors. That's the fun stuff. But I'd also say that that's a little easier than, you know, understanding how do you influence the environment? How do you connect the dots so that you can have kinetic effects or even non-kinetic effects? And, you know, my 2007 to 2009, everybody wanted to run commandos, which I got to do, which was fun. But a much harder mission was trying to raise a public defense force in 2009, where most of the male population has already joined the military, joined the army or the police. But being able to use technology to understand relationships of the local national forces, your allies, but also of the adversary, of the enemy, understand how do you influence the environment to then have real battlefield effects. And that's where I think Special Forces doesn't get enough credit. We don't tout our credentials in the scale of warfare, which I think is really powerful. Being able to take a 12-man team and create hundreds of fighters from that, but then also really work with the population to understand how do you really win without fighting, going back to the old adage, right? Moving from the military world into the business world, I still somewhat feel like I'm on a little bit of an island and on my own path, which I kind of enjoy, but it is fantastic to see so many folks now come around, so many companies coming up with great ideas in the technology space. I think it's just absolutely exciting.
Now, as you made that transition, and you mentioned that you were a bit on the island, but there are other people who did it. What are some challenges that you faced? I mean, you were approaching this from a bit more of a technical perspective, but nonetheless, I mean, the transition, figuring out how business works. I mean, what were the obstacles for you as you kind of made that career journey?
Yeah, I mean, really just not having the background, right? So I went to business school. I got my MBA right out of the Army, basically. And, you know, most of the other folks in my business school class had 10 years of business experience, right? They kind of started from low in the ranks and made their way up. And now they were kind of getting ready to take that next big step to manager. And so they had a lot to draw on the business end. I didn't have that, right? Military experience, combat experience, but not a lot. And so I really, you know, once I committed myself to leaving the Army and going into the business space, I really just dove into business. I'd read the Financial Times every day, the Wall Street Journal, watching Bloomberg. I still do today. Just trying to understand the macro indicators and warnings of that something's going to happen or the drivers of something, and then being able to drill it down and say, okay, where do I play a part in this? And really trying to understand the larger ecosystem on how things are influenced. And then my experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq, especially in Special Forces, I think really going back to 9/11, right? I view 9/11 as the start of this new age that everybody now realizes we're in, where it's a lot more chaotic and geopolitics is much more important than it used to be for the past 20 or 30 years, right? It used to be a check the box. It's globalization. It's free trade. Things are peaceful out there. Security's not really a big deal, right? It's more compliance, right? And we just got to make sure that we do the things we do, check the box, and we're going home. 9/11 is that catalyst event that changed things, right? It really ushered in a new era of volatility, which I think is the world's kind of default, but we've just been lucky to live in a period that's been relatively peaceful for the last few decades. And so now really understanding my military experience has helped me understand this world of volatility, I think, a lot better than if you were just in the business world without that background, right? Because now it's chaos and you don't have a frame of reference to understand how the world kind of is working now, as opposed to being in the middle of nowhere in Afghanistan. It's really, you know, warrior rules, and being used to be able to do business in that type of environment, I think sets us up well for understanding how the world is working. So I didn't have a lot to draw on, but as the world has changed, I feel like my experiences now are a lot more relevant than they might have been in the past. And that's really what I'm seeing across the board when I'm talking to my customers, my clients, industry. You know, it's, they have a lot of great business experience. A lot of them actually do have a lot of either intelligence community or military experience, which is great. But the business and the companies don't have that kind of knowledge. And so they're really looking to understand how security plays a much more important role in business today than it used to.
Yeah. Well, that's a good segue into your early business experience. I want to talk about Torchlight, but I'll come back to it in a second. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about, you know, you left the military, you entered the private sector, a couple of ventures along the way. Talk a little bit about what came before Torchlight.
Sure. Well, you know, when I got my MBA, I landed back in the Washington, D.C. area, you know, did a little bit of management consulting work where we really worked on projects for defense contractors. So I was able to dig in and understand the defense budget and understand how companies kind of take advantage and plan based on that. It was very interesting work, very informative, but not really my cup of tea. And so along the way, I started a company called Nisos Group. And really what we did is we recruited folks from really CIA, NSA, and the military, where we would provide red teaming solutions for our customers. And at that time, you know, there were a lot of cybersecurity companies going on. It was still pretty hot and there were a lot of red teaming, but we took a different bend. And what we did was we really replicated nation state actors against corporate security, against corporate infrastructure. So we said, look, you've got the ones and zeros button down, but you know, the way they're going to get to you is through other means, because they are nation states. They have a lot more resources than a single company. And so here's how they're going to play it. And we would do basically red teaming, where we do a lot of social things that folks know about today, but weren't as well known then. A lot of social engineering, more drawing the human side into it to start, which then you can pivot into the digital side, right? Making friends with those traditional, you know, espionage, traditional type of information gathering that gives you that access that you need. And that's really what we did, especially for large technology companies, financial institutions, who are, frankly, our targets of nation states, have been for a while. I think everybody's pretty aware of that now. And that's what we did. And it was really great. It was a small little boutique shop, and we kind of did some really fun projects. It gave me a ton of insight into how corporate security teams are set up. And the biggest takeaway from that was that the physical game does not talk to the cyber game.
Yep. That's very up in every podcast. So Maybe we'll solve the problem today. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll get there.
We'll find out. But that wasn't the last venture. You had another one after that, correct? Before Torchlight?
Well, it was really just consulting. So after Nisos Group, I set up my own shingle. And really where Nisos led me was I started getting a lot of very interesting phone calls. Hey, I heard you can help solve some problems, which is kind of a cool place to be, right? I was like a general contractor where I put together certain teams based on the problem that the client was calling me on. Hey, I've got this problem or that problem. Oh, I can find guys for that. And I put the team together and go try and solve it, whether it was intellectual property walked out the door or they've got some insider threat. And it was really still in that world of blending the physical and the digital side of things, the human nature plus the ones and zeros, to really get a more holistic look at things, which was great. You know, some really cool projects around that. It was one of those where my response was always like, oh, I got a guy. So it was really good to have a network of guys like.
Absolutely. At some time around this time, I think you mentioned to me before that this is when the light bulb came on about the tech revolution and security. which led you to Torchlight, as I understand it. And so could you tell me, when you use that phrase, tech revolution and security, and how technology is transforming security, what does that mean to you? And then I would love to lead that into the Torchlight story.
Yeah, you know, most of what I saw was, look, there were the CISOs have a really hard job. They got to try and keep everybody out. You know, everybody's taking shots on goal with these guys, and they have to try and block every single one 100% of the time. That's a damn tough job to have to fill. And so they really do have to rely on programmatic solutions for that. They have to rely on tools that can run in the background and kind of detect things on their own. But really, through my work in ESOS and Sense, was, you know, those vectors that are not programmatic, that are backed by nation states, have the ability to circumvent that and find more creative ways to get in. And so, you know, really what I started looking at was, how do you use data, different types of data, to pick up different indicators? And what are those indicators? And just not being a technologist by trade, I always kind of go back to what I know, which is more of the human element. And that led me down the path of geolocation data and understanding, because, you know, look, we all realize that we're pumping out just all kinds of signals every single day with everything that we're connected to, right? It's pretty ridiculous. Started by looking at different spots around the world. How do you collect data out of there that could indicate that a group was doing something? And that's where, in between my work after NISOS and then Torchlight, where my head was and my research was, it was around, what is that data? How do you get your hands on it? And how do you really start to make sense of it? Which kind of led me towards geolocation data, right? Understanding patterns of behavior, understanding how people interact and what changes and anomalies look like, or what patterns look like. So you can still, on the same path, blending that physical and digital side of things, but how do you use more data coming off the human side, so you're less reliant on people per se, and now you can get a lot more programmatic about it. Now you can start to really look at it at scale. And so that's where my head was leading up to Torchlight, which fit in really well with what we do now.
Yeah. To that end, tell us a little bit about, you know, if you had to put a bow on it, what does Torchlight do?
Yeah, exactly. Torchlight uses that geolocation data. We suck it up, and then we make sense of it. We don't collect our own. We buy it out there, right? Because it's ubiquitous. It's absolutely everywhere. So you can buy it, which we do. But then we apply behavior analytics to it. And that's what makes us special, is we have our own behavior analytics. It's really built off a lot of experiences from the guys on the teams that we have. A lot of very, very deep bench when it comes to intelligence community, special operations, who know the threat actor. And that's the overall theme of my career has been, how do you understand the threat actor deeper in a way you can prevent them from causing harm? And so what these behavior models do basically is, you know, we identify patterns and anomalies, and we look at all the data through these models, and we can say, hey, this pattern looks very much like a Chinese MSS or Wagner Group, or, you know, you name a group, put some lines around that activity. What's really interesting about this data, right, is the original use is for marketing. And by marketing, it's buying intent, right? Hey, I see John, and he's going to Starbucks, and he's going to Target, and he's going to, you know, Disneyland with his family, I'll bet you I can sell him something. But what if we looked at it in a different way? What if we weren't looking at it at purchasing power, buying intent? What if we looked at it from a security standpoint? We said, hey, look, this pattern here is an indicator of something to happen, right? It's an indicator of a potential breach or violent activity. CEO of United Healthcare, who was assassinated in Manhattan in the last year, right? Like, what are the patterns that led up to that horrible incident? And how do we identify those and then identify them again in the future to prevent that from happening? And that's really the intent and the power of the data that we're bringing in, because this data is so rich in features. We're able to see so much about everything. Now, we don't deal in PII, so we don't know that it's John's or tablet or whatever it may be, a name or an email or any of that. We stay very clear from PII. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, adds additional, I'm sure.
Yeah. The whole point is, how do we identify those early indicators and warnings so that we can prevent something from happening? And that's really what we do at Torchlight for the government, but also the corporate side.
And I know that you've had a few cases that you've been able to publish on, at least semi-public. What's a good story that you would share from a real world scenario that you were able to plot data to and watch what's going on that you'd be able to share in public?
Yeah, we published a couple that were around a lot of coups that happened almost 2 years now in Africa. You know, Russia was making a big push into Africa through a lot of their proxies like Wagner and some others. And what we were able to do, which what's great about our data holdings is that if an event happens, you can isolate where and when that happened and rewind the tapes. So we have basically 12 months of data, rolling data in our system. So if something happens, you can isolate that event and then see what were the patterns leading up to it. And so we did this in a coup. I forget the countries where it happened, but we did this in a coup in Africa. And then like 2 weeks later, another coup happened. And so we had two great examples where we could rewind the tapes, and we saw tons of Russian activity around presidential palaces, government facilities, everywhere you would suspect in order to help facilitate, support a coup, you would want to really have your access and placement into. And that's what we saw, right? We saw devices emitting Russian behaviors in our system, visiting presidential palaces, visiting departments or ministries of communication, right? To make sure you have the airwaves locked down. We saw that activity leading up to these coups. And then we said, hey, that's a model, right, that you could start to apply to other countries going forward. So when you think about geopolitical unrest or volatility, you know, it is still very specific kind of to Africa, but we have a bit of a working model now. Hey, this is how Russia does business when they're trying to foment instability. And so that's a really great example. It doesn't have to be something as dramatic as a presidential coup. It could be, you know, something more level, low level, like local criminality or some things of that nature, right? But it's the same concept where you can start to see those patterns leading up to it and apply it.
Yeah. Well, and I would think that, you know, those are really good geopolitical examples, but the applications for things like active shooter or, you know, the Navy Yard shooting a few years back.
Right.
The thing that I'd be curious about is if you think about a company, visitor management, because that's kind of the domain that I live in.
Right.
If you're thinking about visitors moving in and out of facilities, you could obviously find out some things about them. You may not be able to find out everything about them because you're limited in what PII you can collect. What are some things that companies that are solving problems like that, you're thinking about just human beings moving across spaces, in which this kind of analytical toolkit could apply?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, when you talk about the active shooter issues, you know, very rarely does something happen in isolation. There's typically some reconnaissance, you know, there's some planning that goes into it. Even for folks who are very driven by emotion, there's usually planning that goes into it. And so that's where I think there's a really great interconnection between visitor management and what we do with the behavior analytics, because the visitor management is already pulling all the information to understand who's coming into your building, which is very valuable. But if you're not understanding what happens before they come into your building, right, that's the missing piece that we're trying to identify. And the more that we can align with visitor management and the other security systems around, whether it's CCTV or other on-network type of alerting platforms, really trying to get left of boom, as we used to say, right? How do we understand something before it happens? And that's the power of where we
play. Appreciate it. The naval reference.
Yeah, right. Right. So that's where, you know, I see the power of this, especially in the corporate sector, right? The shooting that happened in New York last week, really horrible. What led up to that? We're not looking at Facebook or Twitter. How do you identify potentially some really early indicators where people are just kind of blowing off steam online? How do you draw that to their physical movements and the patterns they're setting once they enter the building and everything that happens in between? I think there's a lot of great power with the data, with the technology now, and it's only getting more intense.
How do you handle situations where, I mean, ideally, these are all low probability events, right? So there isn't a whole lot of positive data to model from. There are only so many coups and shootings. When you're trying to train a model to predict those kinds of activities, what are some of the challenges and how do you work around it when you're trying to get at things that are sufficiently low probability that you can't just model them straight, but you've got to provide indicators or heuristics that help decision makers make decisions?
Yeah, those big events, they're kind of like tail risk, right? Like they're big events, they're low probability, knock on wood. So, you know, I think security professionals need to be aware of those and kind of be ready for them. But I think it's the more, I don't want to say mundane, but less devastating, less catastrophic type events. Like let's say intellectual property theft or just some criminality around your location, right? Somebody trying to steal something. We work with some energy companies, right? And they're very concerned about, oh, there's substations everywhere around. Like it just takes a little pot shot to black out part of a city. So how do you really start to pick up those indicators? And how do you draw the line between, and this is where our modeling comes in, right? It's very, very precise geolocation where, well, we're drawing polygons around a location on the ground. we want to make those polygons as tight as possible to the property lines, because if we end up getting in part of the sidewalk or part of the freeway that runs next to it, we're going to get all kinds of noise in there that doesn't really matter to us, right? And so the model has to be pretty precise, which we take a lot of care in doing. But I think that gives you a lot more data to train on, right? Because those events are a lot more common. It might be a teenager screwing off somewhere, or it might not be. How do you start to pick those up? And what we've seen is most of the corporate security teams have really good incident response where they can call manned guard or the cops to come out. So you have kind of like after action review, right? You know what happened after that. And you can say, okay, here's the pattern that led up to it. Here's the event. Here's how it was resolved or not resolved. And you can start to see those same types of patterns. So those are a lot more common to deal with, to train the models on. But still, it is like, you know, our models don't say, hey, this pattern equals Vladimir Putin at your gates. Like, we're not that tight yet. I'd love to be that tight, but still, it's really like we're at the point is how do we at least just raise the flag for the security professional to say, hey, this is something I need to dive into a little bit more. And I think that's the power of where AI comes in, is you can do that a lot faster. You can slim down that workflow quite significantly and raise the flags that actually matter and not inundate me with just noise.
Well, in that vein, I mean, you think about the kind of security professionals who would use your toolkit. My hunch is that there are several different kinds of skills or even mindsets that have to be in place for them to be successful. I mean, and having spent a lot of time around security teams, they're not always necessarily very data-driven. They are also somewhat skeptical of new methodological approaches. I mean, you mentioned AI 2 years ago, and not a thing, and here we are. So if you had to describe the kinds of talent that security teams need to be building in order to be able to do this, right? So let's say they go buy Torchlight or whatever, or a similar product or a set of tools that is game-changing. What do those teams need to have on board in terms of talent to make it work?
Yeah, great question. We run into this a lot because, you know, in the government space, they have that capacity. You know, they have a SIGINT analyst who is used to, or an all-source analyst who is used to running lots of different tools at the same time, lots of classified stuff, a lot of cool stuff at their hands, and coming up with an answer, right? And a recommendation to a decision maker. We don't see that at all on the corporate side.
You would think it'd be the other way around, but it's not.
It is not. Yeah, exactly. The talent's equally as great, right? It's not no knock on anybody on the commercial side of things, on the corporate side. There's just not as much. The benches aren't as deep. So what we see is, hey, just give me the answer. Like, I just need the answer right away. I don't have time to do the investigations myself. I don't have a team here. It's just me, or it's, you know, only a few people. It's usually a skeleton crew that I run into. By design, right? I think it's cost center, number one, but two, it's been relatively stable past several decades, like we talked. So what I run into a lot of times, and I typically do a lot of pre-work for our customers to show them kind of what they look like in our platform, but they don't have the capacity, to your point. They say, hey, this is really powerful stuff. I would love to connect it and synchronize it with all of my other platforms, visitor management, my cameras, but I don't have that bench to be able to do that. So we end up doing a lot of that work for them. And actually, they rely on us quite a lot to be able to kind of get to the answer. What they really need at the end of the day is, hey, give me the indicator or the warning right away and tell me what I need to do about it. It's got to be, you know, down and dirty, really to the point. Which is a bit of a challenge because the products that we really started with were designed more for military use, where you have a signals intelligence person sitting there that knows how to interrogate the data. So what we've had to do is really take our product that was designed for investigations and for targeting. All right, how do we slim down the workflow, make the workflow kind of transparent, or, you know, kind of in the background, not put that on the user itself and really just kind of spit out the answer. And so we're still working on that, but really where that comes down to is we end up doing a lot of the work side by side with our clients to be able to get to the answer in a more of a managed service type.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What I've been seeing is like corporate teams are hungry for this data, right? Because it has not been very data driven. So they want it. They want to understand it. I got a report this morning that less than 40% of corporate teams are using geospatial data in any way whatsoever, right? Everybody's using social media and OSINT, which is, you know, take it with a grain of salt because people can say whatever they want online, but their
movement actually demonstrates intent.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But how do you pair all this together? So I think there's still a big opportunity there using the geospatial data to really be a lot more data driven. which then allows them to talk to their CISO counterparts in the same language and then really start talking to the C-suite in a much more data-driven way.
So in that vein, I mean, you might be have given me the answer already. If you think about these corporate teams that you've worked with, aside from a fantastic toolkit like yours, what is the key investment they need to make in order to be ready to do this the right way? Well, what's the typical gap that you see?
There's a couple gaps. I would say number one is capacity, probably the team on the bench to be able to run a tool like this.
Yeah, like because you haven't even put enough attention to security, period. Right.
Yeah. Right. Because, you know, if I'm in the C-suite and my head of physical security is telling me that we've got a red flag here popping off, we got a potential incident coming up, we're seeing early indicators, I'd want to ask why. Like, how do we know this thing is real? How do we know the data is good? Where is it coming from? And so that security professional is going to need to understand how it works. I think with the OSINT stuff, with, you know, understanding social media, everybody's more or less got an understanding how that works these days. But the geospatial side, there's not as much capacity. There's not as much talent on these teams to run the tools, or they've got a lot of tools to choose from. Not enough people, not enough hours in the day. Then two, I'd say for the security leadership team to be really much more data driven to understand, hey, these are the strengths and weaknesses of each of these tools, right? Because you're not going to get one that just solves all your problems right away. So the more you can understand how they work together to solve the use cases you're working for, protect your business, the better. And that's what I try and do a lot of times with our customers, and really try and understand their business so that I can help them understand how to really employ our tool in the right way. Because it's not all the same. Every company is very, very different, even in the same industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that does sort of bring me to the privacy and legal problem. And this applies to government too. I mean, I was talking to a former government official who was just as worried about this problem as it relates to credentialing and public trust and granting clearances and sharing threat information. The problem of individual data, PII specifically, trust, disclosure, what are some of the most important privacy and legal challenges in using behavioral analytics effectively in this area?
I think, you know, as Americans, we don't like the government knowing much about us, right? We want to give the government as little information as possible. But this is a very powerful type of tool and data. It's very, very rich. So the question is, how do we use this in a morally and legally righteous way where we can protect business, protect life and property in our national security while not infringing on the rights of Americans, right? And that's the path that we try and take at Torchlight. So number one, we don't deal with any PII in our system. So we buy this data from brokers, but we don't get any personal information, right? We're getting device activity. Hey, we see a device and it's moving around here doing these things. I can't tell you in my system that this is John's device. I can't tell you anything about you or your life other than your patterns that you're actively, you know, using through your device. So we're not getting the emails or phone numbers or social media handles, any of that. And that's very much by design. There are other tools that you can do that with. The few that are focused within the United States have the legal authorities to be able to look really for kind of threats to homeland, which is good. But then on a corporate side, we have spent a lot of time really understanding the rules of the road. And I'll tell you, they change almost hourly, which is challenging. But the general law of the land right now is as long as we're not dealing in PII, it's being used to protect property, used to protect the safety of employees. It's basically cleared hot to be able to do that, which is good. Now, we don't want to go down that route to be able to see personally identifiable information. I think our tool is very powerful without that. It kind of keeps us away from that. It is something that I deal with almost weekly, right? We're trying to understand, okay, what new legislation is coming out? How do we make sure that we're staying true to the law and true to what we want to be as a company? But I think there is a lot of risk inherent there. And as geospatial data becomes more prevalent, you know, I think that's a worthwhile question to ask vendors, like, what is your stance when it comes to this type of information? How are you safely handling it? You know, give me some examples of how you handle this information, what information you collect, and what do you do with it afterwards? To do business with the government, I mean, you know, we've done a pretty good job, I think, of setting up those safeguards within the company. But still, you know, as an American, I don't want everybody having my information either. So it is a bit of a fine line.
I mean, it's a tough problem. I mean, think about a bigger company. that has the capacity to purchase a tool like yours, for example, where they're collecting data that does not have PII in it. But you may also subscribe to a variety of other data sources, PII, like credit scores, you know, social media, a variety of other things in which they could associate that data on their side.
Right.
What are the ethical guidelines that the security leaders should be thinking about? Because in the end, they can do a lot of things, probably legally. Where do you draw the line?
I think it's got to be pretty well documented within the security team's processes, right? It's got to have a justified need to be able to get to that level of granularity on an incident, right? Because ultimately, you're wanting to protect your property, the safety of your employees. If there is a lot of criminality involved, you do want to potentially refer it to law enforcement if it goes that way, which is the right thing to do. But how do you, you know, what I would say is, you know, we don't want Barney Fife out front of his ex-girlfriend's house using our system, right? Like that's the worst case scenario, or some security professional, right? Just using it in a way they shouldn't use it.
I understand the Barney Fife. I'm not sure anyone under 40 will know who the hell you're talking about, Jim.
Fair enough.
It reminds me of watching Andy Griffith reruns when I was 8 years old.
No. So part of it too is like, you know, a judgment on our call, like who are we going to do business with? You know, I don't want to, like, I want to grow a business, obviously, but I don't want to do business with folks that are going to use my technology in an ethically questionable way. Understanding, you know, having the right bona fides with them, understanding who's running the team, you know, what kind of team it is. It's important for us too, just for good business practices. But yeah, they can get there. And, you know, we've had clients who they have some pretty serious issues going on and they do want to get in touch with law enforcement to take action, right? So it really comes down to the people using the tool. It's not the you know, and that's really the way it is. Like anything can be misused. Not to say we don't care at all. We very much do. We don't do business with lots of folks on purpose. But I think that just goes back to the conversation we just had about talent on the team, right? Like you got to make sure that the people know how to use this data, use the technology in the right way, and they're doing it for the right purpose. And, you know, those companies need to have their guidelines as well.
Yeah, that's great guidance. Good stuff. Which does bring me to where we are headed. I mean, we just described it's already potentially scary what companies are able to do ethically inside their companies. Well, let's pivot for a second and talk about where we're headed. I mean, obviously, you're dealing with data. You're watching AI happen, which accelerates the use of data dramatically and the potential use cases of it. What do you think the two or three critical trends are that especially security leaders need to be paying attention to as it pertains to data that are going to play out over the next 4 or 5 years?
With all this data, my mind goes towards continuously running models, looking for these types of patterns, right? And collecting it, not just in our platform, but really correlating it with all the other platforms. Because you look at visitor management, right? You can put all kinds of AI in that type of thing, right? And understand who's coming to your building. Do you need to market to them? Do you need to put them on a do not enter list? All kinds of things, right? The AI can take that grunt work out of it. You look at traditional cameras, security cameras, right? You can put all kinds of computer vision on those things nowadays and spot guns and intent, you know, and all kinds of things that they're carrying, which is, I think, really powerful stuff. But where my head goes is, right, how do you create the AI that brings it all together and makes sense of it? To get to that bottom line, say, hey, we've got a security issue here. I think when you're dealing in security, at the end of the day, it does kind of come down to life or death, not to put too much of a heavy point on it, but like you don't want to make mistakes like that when it comes to security. So I'm very cautious about what type of AI should come in from a security standpoint, right? I really think where we are right now and probably for the next, I'd say, couple of years, maybe this stuff moving so fast, so maybe it's a couple months, who knows, but really shrinking work, right? Like taking the burden of grunt work off of the security professional desk. That's really where I see the value in AI in the near term. But where it could go, I think, is really getting to that. So the security team doesn't have to staff up with tons and tons of headcount that's going to impact the bottom line. You can use the AI for that. But I think those models are almost going to be customized per company. Right? Because every company is so different, different ways they value risk. One extreme risk in one company in the same industry could be completely different than another company in the same industry. And so I think these models are going to be very, very personalized for the company, but I'm going to be like, there's got to be a lot of trust that goes in there. I just don't see the human coming out of the loop when it comes to security and defense either. I mean, that's a big topic of discussion on the defense side, right? Every executive is saying, there's going to be humans in the loop for the foreseeable future, right? There's not going to be robot on robot wars. Soon there's got to be some humans in there. I think it's the same on the corporate security side, right? There's got to be somebody making sense of it, saying, hey, wait a minute. Where'd you get that answer? How'd you get that thing? It's just not reliable yet. So look, I think there's a lot of value there. There's a lot of opportunity, but I wouldn't, you know, drink the Kool-Aid just yet. I think security professionals need to really understand how it's made, what data it's coming from, and really understand the quality of the data that's going into it and then the quality of the models.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the things that has come up on a few conversations I've had is this challenge opportunity dynamic of AI specifically. What do you think it's going to do to the threat environment? Obviously, there's the possibility of false positives and you're not really understanding what's happening effectively and directing you down the wrong path if you're not paying attention. On the other hand, there's the adversarial use of this stuff in order to attack companies and the government, quite frankly. What are your thoughts on that? And what should security leaders be thinking about as it relates to AI as an adversary?
Well, I think nation states are the ones you really need to worry about. And by that, I extend it to their proxies, right? Who have the financial backing of the nation states, right? They only have to be right one time. And the more lines you could throw out in the water, the bigger chances are you're going to catch something. So the fact that they can, not just even from a brute force sense, but also from a deception sense, right? If they make you think something's going to happen over here and the issue and the security problems over here, and they're coming around the back door and they can walk right in, right? I really think it's going to exponentially explode the way that adversaries can do what they do. They can do it while they're sleeping now. So as a security professional, you need to be able to have it running while you're sleeping as well, right? And I think the problem with security is you're kind of playing catch up always. It's kind of a defensive mindset. I'll go back to this, get left to boom, right? The more we can understand intent before it happens, the more we can be more proactive about it. It's like that Wayne Gretzky saying, skate to where the puck is going to be, not where it is now. That really does start with an intimate understanding of who are the threat actors targeting you. Because, you know, it's one thing to say China, Russia, Iran, but if you're a private company, like that's so esoteric from your day-to-day business, right? How do you really put that in a more realistic sense? And so being almost having like threat profiles, understanding who are the threat actors that are kind of actively targeting you, what kind of techniques do they use? What technology do they use? Really get inside their mindset so that you can be ready to parlay those ones that come, but also have your head on a swivel so you can understand what's coming down the pike. I think it's a security professionals have a tremendous burden on them, and it's only going to get tougher. That's really where my head has been since I left the military, is how do you get inside the adversary's head and understand what he's going to do before he does it so you can kind of head him off past the challenge coming.
It is. In that vein, if you were in charge of everybody's security team and they had to study one skill set, piece of tradecraft, domain, what would you tell them to bone up on?
Cyber side, quite honestly, because that's the way you're going to exfil value, right? Well, let me qualify this, right? I'd say the cyber side, because I think most of the problems you're facing is probably like theft of intellectual property in some way, right? That's probably the most common. You're still going to need to deal with active shooter, you know, those types of horrible issues. But the closer physical security and cybersecurity can come together and quite honestly overlap, the better. It's like two different languages right now. I've seen some great examples, but it's not pervasive.
It's incredible. And I think our vocabulary doesn't help us on this. This comes up a lot in my conversations. We've invented these various terms. Cyber is one of them. Information security is another one. Physical is one of them. Personnel security is another one. You'll have InfoSec. You'll have various sort of permutations of these various things. And they end up turning into departments rather than cross-functionally training. You get stuck in one and they don't know how to talk to each other.
I think that's the biggest issue. Quite honestly, from a business, it makes good business sense too. You'll get synergies out of, you know, closer alignment with the two. There's less redundancy. You're all speaking the same language. You're looking at the threats and the environment the same way, because the adversary doesn't give a shit about what department you're in, right? They're coming after you. And if they have to use people on the ground or hackers online, they're going to come after you. So it doesn't matter to them.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, I love to wrap these conversations up with a few rapid fire questions.
All right.
So I have not run these by you. I'm sure you will be on them quickly.
I will not. I'll try not to plead the fifth.
There are no cash prizes, so there's very little at stake. First one is an easy one. Do you feel like the military or corporate experience has been more important for your leadership growth? What's been the better source of leadership growth?
That's a great question. I'd say the military is foundational. in my mind. You learn how to be a leader. I've had to translate it, though, into the corporate side. It's different.
Quite. While we're on the military topic, absolute worst assignment or duty station?
So many to choose from.
Probably not the most dangerous ones.
My last job in the Army, I was a human resources branch chief out of Fort Knox, Kentucky. I never had a weapon assigned to me in my 10 years. So that was the worst job. Worst job.
The part of the reason I got roped into this whole career path in the first place, by the way, Jim, is I was, as a collateral duty, as an ensign in the Navy, I somehow had to be the unit security officer.
Nice.
And it was nice. Pretty terrible, actually.
Yeah, I heard this one. I was in a call center. I had to wear a uniform every day. I was in a call center. This is the Army? This is great.
All right, third one. This one's fun. What is one book every security leader must read?
Good question. You know, my head goes to Unrestricted Warfare. I forget the authors, but it's two Chinese generals who wrote it after the Gulf War. They saw how the U.S. won so decisively with the use of our technology, and they basically came up with their doctrine and say, this is how you defeat the U.S. It's societal, right? It's not just military. It's economic. It's cultural. It's everything. And the more we as the U.S. can understand that, the more that we can understand that we're all kind of in this fight together. The government is not separate from the corporate world when it comes to security threats. They're the same threats out there.
That's great. That's awesome advice. All right. With that, I want to give you the last word. What is the key takeaway you want everybody to leave with as we wrap up today?
Yeah, look, first, I really appreciate this opportunity. This has been fun. I would say that data-driven, right? If it hasn't already gotten to you, it's coming. And the more you can understand which data actually matters for your company and your security programs, the better. And just get so smart on it, because it is the way of the future.
Thanks for joining us on Secure Access, brought to you by Sign In Solutions. If you found today's conversation insightful, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more on transforming compliance, security, and workplace experiences, visit signinsolutions.com. Until next time, stay secure, stay informed.